Where it's going to go, I'm not sure, but I know that this is a very, overall, a very good time for us as a true American living in this world. With the climate change and things of that nature, it starts to get very scary because you think your home is your home, and all of a sudden there's a flood. All of a sudden there are storms that are unprecedented. So there's some changes going on that are quite substantial, and I don't know exactly where nature is going to take us in the long run.
Yeah, it concerns me pretty much every day. And I don't know if you saw it. There was this guy who recently was fired from MSNBC. They did a special. One guy who's kind of progressive with 20 young far right leaning people, and it was a kind of versus. The one guy versus the 20, and too many of the 20. Younger people, men and women, really presented themselves as fascists and very proud of it. Very disconcerting to see.
Get away from the politics. I want to talk about radio.
Okay, we'll go back to radio. What do you want to say, Howard?
Yeah, the question I want to ask, climate change. Yes, we're going through climate change. We always said climate change. And you go back 100 years, we had hot days. Do you feel it's due to what we're doing with energy? Or do you feel it's just part of the normal cycles? This planet's had the ice age. We've had warmer periods of time. We've actually had more CO if we go back hundreds of years or thousands of years. So I'm just curious what you feel from a scientific point. Do you feel that this climate change is something that we can change, or just something that the universe is controlling? What's your opinion on all of that?
I'd be happy to take it back to radio politics.
One second. Let me just finish this, and then we'll move back to regular stuff. I believe that carbon dioxide concentrations and temperatures have shifted dramatically throughout the billions of years that the Earth existed. But I believe that we are accelerating this abrupt change because we are burning far more fuel than we ever did, and we are stoking the atmosphere with levels of carbon dioxide that haven't been around since a previous age of the Earth. So is it a natural process? Well, we're natural, and we're doing it, so it's a natural process. Can it be slowed down? Can it be stopped? Maybe, if we put our minds to it, because we may be natural, but we're somewhat clever and hopefully self-protective. So I think, unfortunately, all the carbon dioxide that we're spewing into the atmosphere is being recorded. You can see that the levels are increasing. You can see that the temperature is going up. It's going to have a severe, massive effect to the Earth. Is it possible that if we weren't here, that in 10, 20 million years from now, there would be another ice age? Probably. But, I mean, that's 10, 20 million years from now. Why do we want to bring on a disaster right now? I realize it's because short-term economic gains are at stake. And no one cares about their children or their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. Just, again, you mentioned, if there's a problem, let God deal with it. Well, that has never been found to be terribly effective way of dealing with problems.
Roy, the question that I have is this, and it's not politics, it's just engineering. Is it good to go to electric cars? Which is more effective? You have to make the battery. Nobody looks at the energy cycle. That's my problem. Nobody looks at the complete cycle. From the time you make the battery, do you make the car? How do you get rid of the stuff? Also, are we ready to give up our lifestyles? I'm sitting in a house of air condition right now. I mean, today it was humid. When it was 95 degrees, they're telling people to go into cooling centers. Some of us can afford air conditioning, others can't. That's not politics. So, it's a trade-off between that. And I think a lot of it is due to, like, the sun. It's things beyond our control. That's all.
As far as I'm aware, there's no scientific study that shows that the sun is burning hotter than it used to. It's the greenhouse effect. It's the amount of carbon dioxide. It's very easy to get a balloon and a helium balloon and then do some studies to figure out what the carbon dioxide concentration is, and it's going up and all that fun stuff. So we're definitely doing it. You mentioned pseudo solutions like electric vehicles are more marketing gimmicks than anything, in my humble opinion. It ultimately depends upon the electrical source of the power that you're using for the electric vehicle. If it's being gotten from a generator that's burning coal or fuel, fossil fuel, then you're still screwed because you're still throwing carbon dioxide up into the air. If somehow you're able to kind of wind energy, water energy, some kind of non-carbon-based energy source, then there might be a benefit to electric vehicles. But the way that things are working out right now, as far as I can see, most of it is just moving the pollution and the carbon dioxide production from the car to the generator, and that's not serving any benefit. And also, there's energy costs to electric vehicles. Batteries don't grow on trees. You know, you have to mine the materials, you have to process the materials, and that takes a lot of energy. It spews another massive amount of carbon dioxide. So are there better options? Yes. Are there pathways to better options? Yes. We're not going to any of them. We stop, because someone is annoyed with wind turbines for some strange reason. So I don't know what's going to become of things like that. The electric vehicles are not a panacea. They're just part of maybe a solution at best. And I think we should endeavor to do that. You don't have to go 100%. You can go 50%. You can go 43.7%. But I don't like this go 0% because what the hell?
It should be left up to the market.
It was in the 1970s called The Limits to Growth. I don't know if any of you read it or heard of it, but it was an analysis of the way the world was operating, and it really was a very bleak picture showing the limits to growth. I think it was a 1972 book. I highly recommend it because it really describes taking different parameters and where we and the results would be a disaster no matter what happened.
Yeah, the fossil fuel industry did research on the subject and came to the same conclusion and then decided how much money they were going to spend hiding it from everyone in the same way that the tobacco industry, when they discovered that tobacco was giving people lung cancer, they spent massive amounts of money to cloud that issue up for decades. So, you know, they live in their own vested interests, and I sort of understand it, even if the rest of the world kind of goes kerblang. But, I mean, the problem is that we have been intermittently predicting disaster for our race versus everything will be peachy keen. You know, back in the very old days, there were going to be overpopulation and there will be run out of food and everyone will starve and everyone will die. Because no one kind of predicted the Green Revolution back in the 70s that have increased the amount of food production in the world massively. So, sometimes it doesn't pay to be 100% pessimistic. There's some place in the middle that's probably good, but everyone wants to veer to the right or to the left. And so you're going to have these arguments, you know, as the place burns down, everyone's going to kind of argue about it.
Okay, Roy, you're right about cars. I mean, you're right. I don't know if windmills is the way to go. But it's impossible to try to produce all of that. Remember, they only last for so long. You know, whatever we got, what are the materials? How do we make the materials? What are the effects? They're having some effects on fish. They're having effects on wildlife. So, you have to look at the whole picture. People tend not to look at the whole thing. You know, people say, oh, look at my car. It's clean. Nothing's coming out of the tailpipe. But they don't want to look at the bigger picture. Where are they getting electricity from? And most people don't realize you don't store electricity. It's a chemical reaction. Is nuclear the way to go? Probably. It's a short-term solution to come to the other type of what's after nuclear. The other one would be powerless and whatever. Okay, enough of this. I just wanted to make the point. I agree with you that some of it is marketing.
Okay, Howard, I think you're searching for fusion reactors. Yeah, that's always 20 years in the future. Jim, is that what you wanted to say?
I have no background in it, but I've heard thorium reactors are a thing. Any comments on that?
Yeah, thorium reactors are interesting. The United States experimented with it all through the 60s, and for some reason, I guess, also because nuclear reactors got a bad rep, so they kind of mothballed the lab. China, of course, picked up the ball, and they're supposedly building a few reactors in China. It's very similar to your standard fission nuclear reactor, except that it's a little bit safer. It doesn't have as much runaway problems. But thorium is an interesting, it's still not quite as clean and carefree as fusion if it ever comes into existence. But it sounds like it's a good idea. And China, of course, uses immense amounts of energy. They're still burning coal. They're burning gas, they're burning coal, they're burning fuel, they burn everything. They're just endlessly, I mean, they're a manufacturing gullet, so they're just wreaking havoc with the carbon dioxide layer above them, and pollution there is awful.
Comment?
Yes, Brian.
The only way to move to alternative fuels is to have all fossil fuels be depleted. Now, with that being said, I wonder, just out of curiosity, and I don't know if nobody knows the answer to this, how much fossil fuels we have remaining?
Well, approximately a lot. And there's no guarantee that you're not going to find other pockets throughout the coming century. How long we have, depending upon how much we use over time, who knows? You never can kind of accurately judge your supplies of raw material because you get them from the ground, and you know the more the price goes up, the more you can extract because you can afford to use expensive means to extract them. So it's not a simple equation, unfortunately. And I would hate for the only reason for fossil fuels to kind of disappear as energy is to run out of them, because they're really useful for all kinds of other things. All these plastic things that you have, they started life as fossil fuels and went from there. So there's a lot of other ways of using fossil fuels other than burning them for energy. So I hope that doesn't happen.
PhD.
Well, the problem is that with fossil fuels creating plastics and the plastics getting into our waterways, microplastics, that's a whole nother discussion. I've read recently that it was estimated that in our own brains, there's approximately a teaspoon of microplastics distributed throughout our brains that have been absorbed from our bloodstream. What do you say to that?
I don't have a clue. And I always kind of frown about things like that because there's no real such thing as uniformity in the real world. So what it is you would have some kind of Gaussian curve of the most likely amount, and it would trail out to both sides. You know, we don't just get a supplement for half a teaspoon. So I look askance at those things. I'm sure there will be all kinds of interesting studies in the future where people who donate their brain will have them kind of reduced and measured the actual plastic, and we'll get a somewhat better understanding. But you know, I mean, deal with the plastic pollution in and of itself. You're not going to stop production of plastic. If you think that you can convince manufacturers and consumers not to buy anything made out of plastic, lots of luck with that. It'll be just as difficult as not using electricity or anything else. So plastic is here to stay. What will probably happen is through the eons, the earth, when trees first came into being, there was no really good organism that recycled them. So there were a lot of trees just sitting there and not rotting away. That's where you get the Carboniferous era that gave us all the charcoal and the coal. They're all trees that couldn't go anyplace. And then all of a sudden, the earth developed, mutated a new kingdom of fungus. Fungus lives on dead trees, and so they had the ability to digest and recycle all of the trees. Inevitably, there will be some organism, either bacteria or fungal, that will be able to metabolize plastic, and then we'll have other sets of problems. I don't think so.
Okay, well, that's a novel thought. From what I've read, they pureed cadavers' brains and then via filtration, other methods, they've discovered that, and a teaspoon is a very inaccurate measure, that there were a few grams of, or a couple of grams, whatever it might be, of microplastics in our brain. And I just wonder if there's any scientific truth to that, honestly.
Again, I don't know. The whole point of the scientific method is to have other unbiased people try the experiment themselves. Very often there have been findings that were exciting and completely wrong that were based on contamination of samples. So could this be a contamination problem? Possibly. I have no idea. Let the process of the scientific method work it out, and eventually we'll know for a fact whether this is a truism or somewhat scurrious, biased, answer, finding, what have you.
ACTPO.
Yep.
So maybe we should let a bunch of amateur radio operators with no scientific or medical training just postulate on the air, and then we can see what happens.
Well, look, if there's one person who respects... Okay, Jim, we'll get to you in a second. If there's anyone who respects the scientific method and scientists, it is on. But still, that doesn't stop the individual walking, talking in the street to kind of blow smoke and tell you what he thinks. If you want to blow holes in it, so be it. If you want to pat him on the head and give him a cookie, so be it. So I would prefer people who don't really know much on the subject to mutter a couple of ideas and, I think that's the least that we should do for these people. Push comes to shove, I would be much more interested in what professionals in the field have to say about it. But, the general public pays the dues for all these things, too. So, I think they deserve to have some kind of a voice. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Roy, I think you said it better than me. I completely agree. I'll take it back half a step where we were talking about fossil fuels. There's some folks that are saying fossil fuels, nobody's ever proven that fossil fuels come from fossils, and that they are from biologic activity, but perhaps they come from geologic activity. I mean, we missed the whole point. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but... experts have been wrong many, many times, as have the man on the street. They should both talk, like we're doing now. looking at.
Yeah. WDKW.
Yeah.
As far as exports are concerned, look at our world of mathematicians and the experts around the 1930s said to Armstrong, FM won't work. If you read The Man of High Fidelity and you understand that, they said FM would not work. It wasn't mathematical, and he came up with FM. I mean, just because you're an expert doesn't mean you know anything. I mean, you have to take the people who don't. I mean, I happen to feel like, look, Everybody said you got to take, the COVID vaccine. I didn't take the COVID vaccine, and I'm okay. So, you know, just because you're a PhD or you're an expert doesn't mean that you're always right.
Experts and non-experts are human beings, and human beings are fallible, and human beings make mistakes, but professionals are usually right 99 times out of 100. The problem is that no one kind of comes back with the 99 things that the experts said this will never work, and they turned out to never work. You pull out the one thing in 100 or 1,000 that was poo-pooed because the theory presently understood wouldn't allow it, but the theory was a limited case situation. So, again, this is the rationale that leads to a lot of silly practices of anecdotal medicine. My cousin, twice removed, had stuck iodine on his head for a week, and he didn't get COVID, so I'm going to stick some iodine on my head for a week. Anecdotal evidence is not worth the paper it's not written on. So, again, when in doubt, listen closely to what the experts say, knowing that they are not 100% correct, but they're usually a lot more correct than you or I will be. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've kicked this dead horse. I thank you all for participating tonight. I hope you enjoyed the exercise, and I hope you'll come back and join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. But now I think is as good a time as any for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
Thank you, Roy.
Thanks, Roy. That was absolutely great. Thank you.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good. Network. Very good. And we're still at the SpaceNet Report, part of the TechNet. And my name is Paul, and this is WS2N. And we'll just go through a couple of the topics. Nothing earth-shattering lately, but a couple of things I just wanted to cover. Crew just came back from the International Space Station on a SpaceX Dragon crew vehicle. And there were, four people on board. Anne was the commander. Nicole Ayers was the pilot. And then you had two other people, one guy from Japan, another one from Russia. And they landed the Pacific Ocean safely. So they're back. So, it's a standard deal with NASA. Roughly every 6 months or so, they return a crew. They call it the crew number 10 because that's the 10th crew that SpaceX has launched for NASA to the International Space Station. Although they've actually launched four other ones with a crew, but not for NASA. They've launched those four for Axiom, private company that's building their own space station that will eventually patch to the ISS at some point. And then when the ISS is ready to be decommissioned, their space station will separate. But anyway, they have their own crews that they train, and NASA accept them to dock with the space station for a couple of weeks,
and then they return to Earth. That's the big difference between the commercial axiom cruise. They for a short period of time. NASA crews come up for roughly 6 months, and then they return. So they're back, and another crew has replaced them. And the standard amount of people is usually seven on the space station. Sometimes they have more temporarily, and that's good news that they made it back okay. Probably the Dragon spacecraft are running good. They've had problems over the years, but they managed to put enough money into it to keep the crew the crews going back and forth. Cargo vehicles is another story. They have the same Dragon cargo vehicle that goes up on a regular basis as well. And they've actually changed the design on that. Originally, they would berth to the space station. I mean, 16 big 5/8 bolts. They used to have like nuts that were attached to motors to attach the spacecraft to the space station. That's been changed over the last couple of years. So those things dock automatically too, just like the crew vehicles. So it's more efficient, although they cannot bring large enough equipment. Some of the science stuff that they brought up or back down is on a large side, and if they do that, they would need to have a berthing system that allows 50 inches to bring something in, where the automated docking system allows roughly 1 meter diameter. Anyway, I thought I'd bring that up. Crews are a priority. Any comments? WS2N.
I'm listening. Just don't have any comments. It seems like a quiet period right now, huh?
Yes, but that does happen, Brian. But that's okay. We're always willing to listen to you guys talk and ask questions or comments. And it's a lot better than me, I think. But I just want to talk about this other mission called Traces. Traces is a two-satellite mission, two relatively large satellites that was just launched from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base by another Space Falcon 9 rocket. And they put two of these spacecraft into orbit, and the idea is to study the magnetic reconnection that goes on in space. They need to know this because this is part of the reason you have auroras on the South Pole and North Pole, because of what goes on with this magnetic reconnection. And the scientists want to know a lot more about it. And these two satellites, called Traces, short for Tandem Reconnection and CUSP Electrodynamics Reconnaissance Satellites, so they're called Traces. And a lot went into this, from what I understand, by NASA, having this these two put together. But it looks like one of them is not operating properly. They just launched this last Thursday. But they're working on it. It's amazing how they can figure out what the problem is and sometimes cure it from mission control. we'll see how they do. I'm still researching it myself. I'm trying to figure out why they really need these particular satellites. There was another type of satellite that they launched a few years ago that, more than a few years ago, 2015, and they were called, it was called the MMS mission, the Magnetospheric Multi-Mission, and they were four large satellites launched on an Atlas V rocket, and each one weighed as much as a car, like 3,000 pounds. And they've been flying in tandem ever since, and they worked 100%. And their mission was to study this magnetic reconnection as well. And they made quite a few discoveries over the years. And they thought, well, maybe 2-3 years, and maybe it'll quit. All four are working good. Even so, they'll keep them running. But you know what? I'm kind of researching, trying to find out what the difference is between the traces and the MMS mission. And is one going to complement the other? It sounds like they are. The traces are going into like a regular polar orbit to try to find what's going on closer to the poles. And the MMS is a different type of orbit. They go all the way out to 40,000 miles. Then they come back with a perigee of roughly 1,000 miles. So they go, way beyond the GPS satellites and way beyond the geosynchronous satellites, for their apogee, and then they come back. And they're examining what's going on with the magnetic reconnection further out in space, and it looks like the tracer ones are probably going to concentrate on what's happening closer to the poles, which is a the ones that are close in are the ones that really affect the aurora. You get a magnetic reconnection, and you have this sun particles coming toward Earth, and these particles all of a sudden become ionized, and they separate and they shoot down toward the atmosphere. So they're going to look into that. I'm glad to see that it wasn't canceled. NASA is in the process of canceling a lot of science missions, which I hope they don't really do. Any comments on the tracer mission?
Certainly interesting, no question about that. That's something to be followed. That's pretty interesting stuff. Has Musk been blowing up any more prototypes of his Starship?
No, not lately. All right, we'll have to wait until looks like the end of August at the earliest, Brian. So we'll see how they do. I mean, 9 down and maybe 10 will be a success for them. What's weird, you got two parts to each rocket. The Starship has the booster, and then they have the Starship itself, which is the equivalent to the second stage. And, every time they launch these things, together, it seems like, sometimes they have somewhat of a success with the upper stage, with the Starship, and then other times they have success with the booster. I think two times or so they've actually caught the booster with these big arms that are attached to the launch pad, for the booster, so that this way they would be able to reuse it Their goal is to eventually do the same with the Starship, the other, you know, the upper section. They haven't done that yet. That thing can, they bring it through the atmosphere and it burns up. I think only one time it made it close down to the water. When I say the water, the Indian Ocean. But that means none of these flights have gone into orbit. And they need to show that they could do that. And not only go into orbit, they needed to do things. They needed to be able to release satellites for they're constantly building new Starlink satellites. They have problems with those things. But they're coming down like shooting stars every now and then. Every couple of days, another one comes through the atmosphere. It fails, and then they have these Hall thrusters to, you know, they come on to deorbit it to make sure it doesn't stay in low Earth orbit. So they need replacements, and this Starship should be able to do that. It's also needed by NASA. So we'd like to take that up apart, call the Starship, and eventually have that orbiting the moon and use that as a human transport system to the moon and back up to orbit on the moon and have that reusable. Of course, they're a long way from that. They need the Starship to eventually, fulfill Elon Musk's dreams of going to Mars. And he wants to build thousands of these things. And of course, I'm not going to hold my breath for any of this stuff. But, you know, it's got a bad failure rate. When Russia tried to launch their big rockets years ago in the 60s, late 60s, well, the N1, and they launched a total of three of them. Each one had 33 engines. It sounds like what Elon Musk has, 33 engines on a booster. Well, every one of the N1s failed for the Russians. They blew up. But the Russians gave up after three. This guy keeps going. He's got nine down, and number 10 is on the drawing board. Any comments?
B2BXL.
Hi, Frank. How you doing? Back to you.
Very good. On more formal note, I would say. Thank you, Nick Control. Anyway, Paul, remember that, whatever we think of him politically, remember that Musk's Falcon 9s blew up the drone ships trying to land them for probably first dozen times. There are loads of videos of the Falcon 1s and the Falcon 9s blowing up. And he was nearly bankrupt before he got it to work, apparently. And now the Falcon 9 is essentially the backbone or linchpin, if you will, of our current manned space program, or crewed space program, I guess they call it now, sending people to the ISS, as well as the Falcon 9 being the mainstay of commercial launches from the United States, I believe, at this point. I think at this point for a commercial launch, you have a choice of either Falcon 9 or Vulcan. And I think Falcon 9s are quite a bit cheaper since they're reused. My only question is does he return the customer's deposit when he gets the Falcon 9 back? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I know. He's perfected the Falcon 9. have a lot of good engineers and people that have, you know, worked through all the problems. They have probably a half a dozen flights crashed on the boats when they first started doing that. And eventually they worked it out. But there's a big difference between this rocket and the Starship one. This thing's made of stainless steel, and you know, you start to wonder if there's a design flaw with this rocket. And a couple of duplicate problems that have actually happened with it. So, I'm a little worried about that. You know, you need this particular rocket to get people to the moon. And there's a lot of other things that, you know, that are part of that. To prove to them, they're going to use the SLS system, Space Launch System with the Orion. You're going to use the boosters from Northrop Grumman. You're going to use Rockwell's upper stage, the liquid hydrogen, you know, with eventually right now the earlier one more. It only has the one engine for the upper stage, but eventually they will have four, you know, they have the in-term cryo propulsion system. That's the one they're using now. And then they're going to have the exploration unit, which has four liquid oxygen engines for the second stage in the future. There's a lot riding on this. There is a plan B if it doesn't work out. You know, I think eventually you launch enough rockets, eventually he's got to be able to pull it together. But I don't know how long it's going to take. He should have been to orbit by now. But the plan B is, as you probably know, Frankie, Blue Origin with Jeff Bezos, he's developing a rocket that will also be used to transport astronauts to and from the moon. You know, for the human landing system. In fact, he's sending the first rocket at the end of this year. It's supposed to go up on one of his New Glenn rockets at the very end of this year, and that will actually land on the moon. Now, it's a big lander. I mean, you know, if you know what the size of the Apollo little landers were, you know, to give you an idea, the legs were a little over 30 feet apart on a lunar lander. It stood maybe, what, 20 feet high. And this thing looks like it's about twice the size. And its purpose, you know, of course, to prove that it will land on the moon, is really a cargo version of what Jeff Bezos wants to build, or is in the process of building, which will be used for human transport. But they're going to do it with the, you know, the first landing, hopefully this year, with the new B7 engine, which is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen system. So that's the plan B. NASA does not have a plan C. So it's either one of these two guys. So I hope Elon gets his act together. He's got a lot of talented workers for him. And so does Blue Origin. Any comments?
Comments?
Frank was going to comment. Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Brian.
I just don't see the point of sending up these chemical rockets one after another. I mean, I mean, to put something in low Earth orbit, I can understand. But if they're just sending them up, I mean, what is the ultimate purpose of these? They're carrying their own fuel, which means they have to go ahead and, of course, account for their own weight. There has to be some sort of, like, real invention, reinvention of propulsion methods. And, you know, something that could actually get out of Earth's atmosphere and also Earth's gravity. But just sending up, like, starships, everything, you just can't, I don't see the purpose, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, for now, the gravity well on Earth is pretty tough. So that's why they need chemical rockets. You need something that's powerful enough to do that, get off the Earth and start traveling, putting up large amounts of mass. And, well, if you're going to get away from Earth, you need to travel at 25,000 miles per hour to do that. Just to orbit, you need 17,500. You know, what a bullet goes, what, 3,000, the equivalent of 3,000. This thing, 3,000 feet a second, you know, countless amount of times of the speed of a bullet, you've got to move big, tons and tons of mass. The only way you're going to do that right now is with a chemical rocket. Now, they are working on, you know, the second stages, of course. Now, well, they're chemical too, liquid hydrogen and all. The first liquid methane engine almost landed. Well, actually, they did say it landed on the moon recently. That was one of the ones that tipped over. But again, it's still a rocket. But what you're looking for is like maybe the ion rockets, the whole ion rockets. We have many satellites and things that are flying around with ion rockets. All 7,000 of the Starlink satellites all have those thrusters on them, the ion, and the same with the new ones from Amazon, the Kuiper satellites. They have like 70 of them up there already. They're going to have over 3,000. They have ion engines. And for getting to the moon, there's going to be spacecraft that have to go to the moon that are going to use ion propulsion. You know, you're going to have cargo vehicles and all that, and they're going to be using that. In fact, the first two pieces of the Gateway space station, if they build it, is a habitat module and a propulsion module. Those two pieces are going to take months and months to get to the moon. And why is that? They're going to launch on a chemical rocket, but then once they're in orbit, they're going to keep firing these ion rockets. There's going to be four of them on that system to eventually push themselves all the way to the moon. Now, it's going to take months on end to do that. You can do that because there's no crew. If you had a crew, you know, you want to get them there within 3 days, like in the Apollo days. And what we're going to do, you know, the next time we go to the moon with the people. And, but then, you know, it's always going to be some kind of chemical launch system. The only other one that doesn't have that, and it wouldn't be good for people, would be spin launch. Put in spin launch Wikipedia, you're into the computer, you got to check this thing out. It's 100-foot contraption, in, you know, it's in diameter, 100 feet. And they put let's call it a projectile, they're going to call it a satellite. and this spinning arm inside this gigantic disc. What they do is they pull a vacuum, inside this disc, and they start up this motor, and they spin it, I don't know how many thousands of times per second, spinning around like Wile E. Coyote, and then all of a sudden it releases, it breaks through this membrane, the vacuum of course disappears at that point, and this thing takes off at 5,000 miles per hour. And they're trying to build that speed up fast enough to get to the miles above the surface, which would be equivalent to other boosters, and then theoretically you would have another second stage on top of that for a small satellite and put that into orbit. I mean, there's actually a group that's doing this spin launch. Anyway, back to you, Brian.
I think that what makes sense is to develop the moon. And I think everything is pointing to that. Transport to and from the moon within 24 hours, not 3 days. And also using the resources on the moon to go ahead and, I don't know about fabricating a rocket, but at least creating fuel for a rocket, because you're only using 1/6 the amount of Earth's gravity. So that should be able to end up with a much smaller rocket. And from there, you'll be able to go ahead and perhaps go places. But I remember we also talked about centrifugal force. But, all in all, it's going to take a long time. I really think that in a lot of ways that, we regressed when it comes to going to the moon, because we're not going ahead and making any real progress in developing it. And it's just been taking far too long. Then you have the project, which is going to go ahead and involve the Apollo on steroids. And, that particular project, I wonder if it's really even worth it. I'm surprised that it was even developed in the first place. So, there's a whole bunch of things I think about.
Oh, yeah, And you got to look at it this way. Their first launch was very successful. When I say they, the Space Launch System by NASA. I mean, the idea was to put a crew capsule into orbit around the moon and bring it back, which is what they did. No crew on board, but they needed to prove its capability. And it came back, landed, and splashed down in the Pacific Ocean, and everything went well. One thing I want to mention, we were talking about reusability before. The Vulcan rocket, the other rockets that Musk has are reusable. Vulcan is working on it, on reusable. So, I listened to Tori. He's the CEO, Tori Bruno, and he was talking about it about a week ago. Actually working on it. I know one of their systems from a couple of years ago that they were, what they were going to do with. But I'm not sure, the years have gone by. I don't know if the engineering has changed, but I think within 6 months or so, they'll probably let us know what they have plans on doing with Vulcan. So we'll see. We'll have to see. Getting late, I just wanted to mention a lander that is being developed by Firefly. and it's called Blue Ghost, Blue Ghost 2. Blue Ghost was a successful landing mission by Firefly not too long ago, and then that landed on the moon, and the goal was to operate it for 14 solid days, and that's exactly what they did. And every milestone that they planned on, they got to. And now they're working on Blue Ghost 2. Blue Ghost 2, their goal is to land that on the far side of the moon. And the main payload that will be attached to Blue Ghost 2 is going to be an antenna for astronomy. And this antenna right now is being constructed and built by Brookhaven Labs right here on Long Island, not too far from me. And not only are they doing the antenna itself, but all the electronics and everything that's involved. It's going to be scanning it's a relatively low frequencies from 1 up to 50 megahertz in frequency. They think that's a good frequency to look at. The universe, they're trying to look not only before galaxies existed, they try to look before stars existed, way back at right after the Big Bang, using an antenna system. I haven't seen the antenna system yet, but I understand it's supposed to be long, it's going to unfold, and it's going to be, I think 3 or 4 of them are going to unfold, and they're going to be 6 foot long. They made it seem like some kind of tube. I haven't figured out exactly what that's going to look like. I do know it's going to be on a rotator. So it will be on a rotator system, so they'll be able to adjust it and make it work. They're going to bring a big battery with them. The battery weighs over 100 pounds. It's supposed to be around almost 7,000 watt hours. So it's going to have a tremendous amount of capability. The reason they need that, it'll be on the far side of the moon. And, the far side of the moon, a lot of people don't know it, of course. Most of you guys do. The far side of the moon is dark for 14 days, and it's daytime for 14 days, just like the near side of the moon. So that's why we shouldn't call it the dark side of the moon. It's the far side of the moon. Well, once this thing lands there, it'll land in daylight. Blue Ghost will do its own experiments, what it wants to do.
That
but,
time,
when
completely.
It's doing what it's got to do, it's going to completely shut down. I mean, there won't be a transistor working on Blue Ghost, except for this antenna system being built by Brookhaven, along with all the electronics involved. And the reason for that is the far side of the moon is, you don't have any interference from Earth satellites or from Earth itself. And once the moon goes into darkness for 14 days, this roughly 6,000 watt battery will come on and power up this antenna system to receive all the signals during lunar night. So, reason it, I know it's RF, but they don't want the sun to be there because the sun gives off all kinds of RF radiation. And, you know, that'll be the goal. And it's a big battery. Once daylight comes again for